and haven't. But for the moment, I'd like to ask you to turn to page 502, or if you don't have this edition, then part 4, book 10, chapter 4, The Lost Dog. You have that? All right, I'm going to give you a little breakdown here of what I intend to do. So I'm going to lecture for about 25 to 30 minutes. Dr. Callan will lecture for the other half of the class. And we will, alas, have said everything we'll have time to say, but not everything we have to say about the brothers Karamazov or the Karamazov brothers.
I'm sorry, what chapter was this?
Chapter 90 of part 102. I'm sorry, I'm kidding. It's chapter 10, part 4.
Okay.
Chapter 4. Boy, it's hard to keep track of these things. All right, chapter 4, book 10, part 4.
Thank you.
The Lost Dog.
Okay.
All right. What I want to show you in this lecture is what happens to this idea I've been pursuing in Dostoevsky, and specifically in the Brothers Karamazov, because it comes to the climax of the novel in the trial scene. In the trial scene, we really see what Dostoevsky is getting at when he deploys this polydigmatic technique, right? And it's kind of amazing, I think. And we'll see it building. So I'm going to show you how it starts with the lost dog. It goes to Smerdyakov's interviews with Ivan. I'm going to skip over Ivan's hallucination and let Dr. Cowan handle that, but it's a part of it. And then we're going to go finally to the trial scene itself, which is quite long, so we won't look at it in great detail. We'll just look at what's happening with the defense and the prosecution. And of course, by then, Ivan and we, that is the narrator, know what actually happened, but nobody else does. Everybody else is using intuition or faith to guide them. And of course, you know that faith is also a narrative. All faith is a narrative. This is what I believe happened. This is what I believe is going to happen. Now, The Lost Dog shows this in miniature. So we're dealing with Kolya and Ilyusha. At the bottom of page 503, Alyosha tells Kolya, who comes up, he says, Kolya has met, this is the first meeting between Kolya and Alyosha. And they like one another, even though Kolya is a 13-year-old boy, a bit precocious, but also, well, I think I was probably this way at 13 too. You know, you throw around a lot of big adult phrases and ideas and all of this, and you can't stand to be thought of as a kid. I don't remember whether I was like this or not, but I probably was. I mean, let's face it. So Kolya is telling a story about himself, which is, I'm all grown up now. And Alyosha is looking at him and seeing an amazingly precocious, but still immature, 13-year-old boy who says, well, I'm 14, really. I'm almost 14, as though that made a big difference. However, Alyosha treats him as though he were grown up. He treats him as an equal. He doesn't condescend to him. He brings him up to his own level. He treats him on his own level. I used to say to my first semester freshman classes, I have some good news and some bad news for you. Which do you want first? You know, this is when you're beginning the Iliad. And they'll say, the good news first. I say, the good news is, you're adults. Okay. What's the bad news? The bad news is, you're adults. And I expect you to discuss this with me as adults now. You're supposed to say intelligent, mature things. I'm going to take your comments very seriously. So this is the way Alyosha handles Kolya, and he appreciates it immediately. He may not agree with Alyosha. He may be suspicious of him a little bit. He's on the defensive in front of Alyosha. But nevertheless, he sees that Alyosha respects him and is not going to put him down because he's only 13 years old, almost 14, of course. All right, so we have a kind of rich depiction of this minor character, Kolya. Kolya reveals as much of Alyosha as he reveals about himself, his own character. But we also see that Kolya is revealed not simply and not even primarily by his attempt to sound more mature and more learned and more thoughtful and intellectual than he really is. After all, he hasn't read these books he refers to. He's only heard about them. So if we all, you know, eventually as adults, we continue this practice intending someday to getting around to reading what everybody thinks we already know. All right, so, and you know, he's very concerned with his appearance. I have a regular pug nose, he says, all of this. at the bottom of 503, tell me, how are things going? Now, what the boys like about Alyosha is that he doesn't try to say anything that will soften what he knows to be true. Ilyusha is very ill. He is certainly dying. That's the story. And Alyosha is not going to tell this 13-year-old boy, look, I'm afraid your friend is not feeling very well, but he'll get all right. He doesn't say that at all. He's dying. You need to know that, because the way you relate to him from here on is going to depend on your knowing that. How awful! You must admit that medicine is a fraud, Karamazov, cried Kolya warmly. Well, you know, 13-year-old boys and everything. I used to have a sign on our refrigerator that said, quick, ask a teenager while they still know everything. Ilyusha has mentioned you often, very often, even in his sleep, in delirium, you know. One can see that you used to be very, very dear to him before the incident with the knife. Then there's another reason. Tell me, is that your dog? Yes, Perezvan. Not Zhuchka? Alyosha looked at Kolya with eyes full of pity. Is she lost forever? I know you would all like it to be Zhuchka. I've heard all about it. Kolya smiled mysteriously. One adverb tips us off to something, but we don't know what it is yet. All right, so then he goes on to tell the story. Now, why is it that Kolya has not been to see Ilyusha for several weeks? What did Ilyusha do that has earned his disapproval temporarily? Oh, no, that's not what does it.
He fed the dog.
No, it's the dog. See, it's not that he attacked him with a knife. He forgives him that. It's that he did harm to the dog. And where did he get the idea of playing this trick on the dog?
Smerdyakov.
Yeah. So, Kolya, already, we see in Kolya, despite his immature grasp of current ideas, we see in him a certain responsibility that makes us feel that he is, despite everything, a young man who's on the right track, who's going to be on the right track, in case you see. So we've already got the beginnings of a narrative laid out for Kolya. What else do we learn about Kolya in relation to the lost dog? What happens?
In this feature later.
Later.
It turns out that Perez Von is actually Zuchka.
Yeah.
And then he brings it back and he's taught him all these tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Brings him to Illusion.
Now, what do we learn about the fact that he's taught him all these tricks? Or her? It's not clear whether it's a male or female dog, but.
Maybe Kolya doesn't know.
Huh? Oh, he doesn't know whether she's male or female? No, it's pretty evident. But in any case, it doesn't matter. As a matter of fact. What does it mean that he trains the dog in this way? What do we learn about Kolya? What kinds of things can the dog do? Uh-huh.
Well, he wanted to present him to Ilyushka, like in all of his glory, is the way that he puts it.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. at the same time, he kind of treats the dog tyrannically as he treats all of his little schoolboy friends.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's okay for a dog, by the way.
Yeah.
Dogs expect you to be the leader of their pack. If you don't do that, then the dog thinks he's going to train you. And believe me, I've got one that's been trying a long time. And he's about this tall. Don't say that. My wife said that, and I got stuck with the dog. My brother-in-law takes him out for walks sometimes, and he says, "Boy," he said, "that dog is really female bait, and I don't mean other dogs." All right. So we learned something though about Kolya is that he knows how to discipline. That we suspect that he is going to be capable of transferring these leadership qualities later on in life. The question is, will he in fact become a tyrant over other people or a true leader? Well, we don't know, but we've got a story set in motion here, do we not, with Kolya? All right. Now, let's look at what happens in the Smerdyakov interviews, which are kind of amazing, really, because Ivan has had a story about Smerdyakov, that he's an ignorant peasant, has very little intelligence, he's sensual like everybody, even, well, I won't say even remotely associated with the Karamazovs, but he may well be a Karamazov. And we know that there's something mysterious about Smerdyakov. And when we find out that he is indeed the murderer, then we understand where he's been all this time. That is, his story is rather murky. We don't quite know what to make of it. Are we supposed to sympathize with him? Everybody seems to hate him, except for Grigory, who seems to have the vocation of just taking care of lost boys, like Dmitri, like Smerdyakov, and, in fact, like Ivan and Alyosha. So Grigory is a man who, you might say, is in his own way responsible, though not very pleasant. But there you have it. But how successful has he been in disciplining Smerdyakov? You see, he's tried his best, but he hasn't really got that far. Smerdyakov, I think, feels, I think we mentioned this last time or the time before, like other bastards in great literature, that the world owes them something, that their fate, that the story that's been imposed on them by the world is an unfair one. And the only way they can right this wrong is by taking things into their own hands. And so in this respect, we see Smerdyakov in part as the victim of a certain kind of social profiling. You know, we call it racial profiling now, where there's social profiling. We do it all the time, even without thinking. I'm talking about social profiling, not racial profiling. I'm not sure what exactly that means. I think it's all social profiling, quite frankly. In some cases, what they call race isn't biologically race. So it's cultural, social. All right. Smerdyakov, on page 590, in the last interview.
Is it the first meeting?
This is the third and last interview with Smerdyakov, chapter 8. Three pages, or two and a half.
Okay.
At the top of 590, I don't understand you. What have I to be afraid of tomorrow? Ivan articulated in astonishment. Suddenly a chill breath of fear did in fact pass over his soul. Smerdyakov measured him with his eyes. You don't understand? He drawled reproachfully. It's a strange thing a clever man should care to play such a farce. Smerdyakov is, of course, parodying Ivan. And in fact, we see that Smerdyakov is a parody of Ivan. And of course, in the hallucination, we see the devil is a parody of Ivan. Or is it Ivan is a parody of the devil? We're not quite sure. In any case, we're dealing here with caricatures in the hallucination section and near caricatures in the case of Smerdyakov. But in Dostoevsky, we have what Bakhtin calls idea heroes. That is, characters that are not allegorical representations of ideas, but characters whose personalities are driven by ideas. In other words, their narrative is the unfolding of an abstract idea, like all men are equal or should be treated equally, or I am a Superman, and so on. Ivan looked at him speechless. The startling, incredibly supercilious tone of this man who had once been his lackey was extraordinary in itself. He had not taken such a tone even at their last interview. Smerdyakov now feels himself superior to Ivan because he knows something Ivan doesn't, and he learned it from Ivan. Ivan has been his teacher, but he's taken it a step beyond Ivan. I tell you, there's nothing to be afraid of. I won't say anything about you. There's no proof against you. I say, how your hands are trembling. Why are your fingers moving like that? Go home. You did not murder him. Ivan started. He remembered Alyosha. I know it was not I. He faltered. Do you? Smerdyakov caught him up again. Ivan jumped up and seized him by the shoulder. Tell me everything, you viper. Tell me everything. Smerdyakov was not in the least scared. He only riveted his eyes on Ivan with the same hatred. Well, it was you who murdered him. That, if that's it, he whispered furiously. Now, you see, we get a kind of intersection of two characters. Who in the novel said everybody is guilty? Remember that?
Zosima.
Yeah. Now you have Zosima and Smerdyakov intersecting. You are guilty. Ivan, what? I'm not guilty. I know it was not I. Well, Ivan sank back on his chair as though pondering something. He laughed malignantly. You mean my going away? What you talked about last time. You stood before me last time and understood it all, and you understand it now. All I understand is that you're mad. Aren't you tired of it? Here we are face to face. What's the use of going on keeping up a farce to each other? Are you still trying to throw it all on me, to my face? You murdered him. You're the real murderer. I was only your instrument, your faithful servant, Icharda. And it was following your words I did it. Did it? Why, did you murder him? Ivan turned cold. And Smerdyakov is struck. You mean? You don't mean to say you really did not know? You know, Ivan says, I am afraid that you're a dream, a phantom sitting here before me, he muttered. And this is the beginning of a turn for Ivan, of course. Because Smerdyakov reassures him that, he says, no doubt he is here, that third between us. I've often wondered if T.S. Eliot was alluding to this passage in The Wasteland towards the end. Who is that third who is always walking alongside us? Eliot quotes from a book called South that was about a South Pole polar expedition just during the time of the First World War. But who is that? What third person? That third is God himself, sir. Providence, sir. He is a third beside us now. Only don't look for him. You won't find him. And then you discover, first of all, Smerdyakov pulls out the money. And then he explains exactly what happened. He did feign a fit. And then, of course, as a result of all the activity, he had a real epileptic fit, conveniently, but nevertheless there. So we see Smerdyakov as cunningly taking advantage of opportunities and then cunningly laying out evidence by tearing open the envelope. He tells us nobody knew where that money was but Fyodor Karamazov and I. It wasn't under the mattress. And so he tears the envelope open, takes the money out, and deliberately throws the envelope on the floor to leave a clue. And he has watched what's happened. He goes over to Grigory, whom Dmitri has knocked down, and he kills the old man from behind, not with the brass knocker that Dmitri had taken, you remember, from Grushenka's house, but with an object that is there in the room and that remains there right under everybody's eyes. So Smerdyakov goes back and lays traps. He doesn't simply cover his traces. He makes sure that somebody else will be blamed for the crime. And the prosecutor takes the bait. So now, let's just look very quickly at book 12. As you're aware, having read through this, notice I am setting forth my own narrative. You have finished this, haven't you? I'm assuming it. So the prosecutor delivers the most brilliant speech of his career. And everybody applauds. But we are amused to see what the audience is here. The courtroom is packed. There's so many people there all over Russia. You see, you didn't have to wait for the 20th century and radio and television and films and all of this. to get this kind of effect. It's already news all over Russia, this trial for parricide. And what you see the prosecutor and the lawyer for the defense doing is playing on a whole series of questions about how to read a story through clues. So it's like two side-by-side detective novels. They offer two different interpretations. And of course, the defense loses. I think not because the prosecutor necessarily has presented a more convincing case, but because there are peasants on the in the jury and merchants. These are men of fact, and they adhere to what the late former president of the University of Dallas called the myth of fact. Now, the lawyer for the defense gives an account that is a critique of everything that the prosecution said. It is, in fact, precisely what just the last few decades we would call a deconstruction of the prosecutor's text, right down the line. How do you know this? You're making assumptions here. You've assumed this. It is equally possible that this could happen. He goes through it detail by detail, and he shows that, in fact, there is an alternate explanation. And so long as this alternate explanation is available, you can't say that these so-called facts are really facts. In fact, he de-factualizes the prosecutor's claims. He undoes the credibility of all the witnesses. It doesn't get Dmitri off, however. But what you see in the climactic trial scene is Dostoevsky bringing up to the level of absolute overt presentation the whole question of what it means to have clashing, multiple, multi-level, and conflicting narratives.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand why, if Smerdyakov wanted to die and kill himself, why didn't he go ahead and leave a note? Since it wasn't going to hurt him and he was going to be dead anyhow. That was one thing I really wondered when I read it.
Because he's convinced that Ivan is just as guilty as he is, that Dmitri is guilty. Mm-hmm. That's his whole point. You're in this too. You're the one who gave me the idea. I'm just your instrument. I'm the least guilty. All I did was kill him. You set these poisonous ideas in motion.
So how is the rest of the book not sort of a critique of Sozuma's speech, his monologue? Not his monologue, but I mean, you know,
mm-hmm. It's a sermon.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Because all I'm seeing is that idea of we're all guilty being put into practical, a real setting, and it turns out to be completely farcical. And even his notion that everyone is in is good. On the interior, I mean, isn't the problem with Smerdyakov that both the prosecutor and the defense are looking for a motive, and there really is no motive for him to kill the old man. He's just an evil character.
No, nobody's just evil, except the devil, of course.
Well,
I mean, if you're a human being, you see, you have free choices. See, now you've got a narrative going here. Smerdyakov is totally irrefutably and irretrievably evil and lost. But he's not. He has choices.
But isn't that,
And what Smerdyakov is doing, look at him in relation to Ivan. What he does is to drive Ivan into the collapse of everything he stood for so far. See, we're all guilty, but we're not all equally guilty. That's the whole point. Each, he doesn't quite say that. Zosima gives us the sense that each is responsible for all. And the problem with Smerdyakov is, of course, that there haven't been enough people responsible for him. They tried to shirk their responsibility towards him.
There were several brothers that were under the care of Grigory and Marfa. They didn't.
Yeah, but they were bastards. See, there's a social. You see, it's a society is as much to blame as the individual here. We impose these things on people without realizing. That's why Ivan is so shocked. I didn't kill him. Well, we can say, I didn't cause that man to be beaten up because he's whatever he is. And we say, well, yes, but if you persist in calling these people names or thinking that way about them, you're going to ultimately cause someone to attack him, thinking that he's doing the right thing. Uh-huh.
But doesn't the narrator go to lengths to show that Smerdyakov is willfully choosing evil? The whole thing with the dog,
he calls, and the fact
that so he's not just a product of society.
Of course not. He's got
he
a free will too. Yeah, he's got a free will too. But what he's reacting against, he's not the product of society. He's reacting against society. He's a rebel. Just like Ivan. Ivan is a rebel in God's universe, his planned narrative. He won't accept it. He's going to return the ticket. Smerdyakov is a rebel because he feels that he has been made an outsider. He has not been given even the least opportunity to show his true worth. So now he's going to say, okay, well, in that case, anything is possible. Ivan has shown him that if there is no God, anything is possible. And so Ivan is responsible. Not just people who've called him a bastard and a stinker and the rest. No, so you see, we always had the opportunity to take these things that are put upon us and work with them one way or the other. And we see in other characters that they're capable of doing that. But does that make Smerdyakov absolutely predestined to be evil? No, of course not. He's a free agent, just like everybody else. He chooses not to be, but he chooses. See? That's what's so important here. He chooses. And he chooses because the idea is flattering to him. It's vanity, ultimately, that causes him to kill old Karamazov. It's just plain old human vanity. There's a little bit of vanity in Kolya, you see, and so on. There's Katerina Ivanovna has degrees of it. We all have some vanity in one degree or another. We all have guilt in one degree or another. But, you know, whoever is without sin, let him cast the first stone. You remember that? So this is what the novel is about. When Zosima says we're all guilty, he means we all participate in one way or another, to some degree or another, in guilt, collective or individual. We're all responsible for that in one way or another. And we are also responsible for good done to another. That is, you can't just say, oh, he chose that, I had nothing to do with it. That's not what Zosima's sermon is about. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And with that understanding, what are we supposed to do with what seems to be presented as the truth that I'm going to butcher his name, but Fedyushka?
Uh-huh.
How do you say it?
Yeah.
That Dmitri says, and it seems to be presented as the case, that he doesn't believe that his client is innocent.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he's even. I mean, how do we then take his argument as?
Well, you see, defense lawyers are defense lawyers because they take on cases like this and they argue them rhetorically and analytically. Whether he believes in Dmitri's innocence or not is beside the point. He's making an analytic argument for his innocence. This happens all the time in legal situations. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any lawyers at all to defend anybody who was charged with a crime. But Dostoevsky very clearly, these two, what drives these two men, the prosecutor and the lawyer for the defense? Their own professional vanity, sure. But in the course of it, they lay out a whole series of rather remarkable events. Well, I better stop because unfortunately we've got a class coming in at about 6:20 with a final exam, and they're going to be on pins and needles, so I better kneel before they come.
Well, thank you, Scott. We want to wrap up Brothers Karamazov today. It's an impossible task, but I'm going to try and touch on some of the major scenes, and if I step back on the toes of some of the scenes that you've done, I apologize.
Well, it's dialogical, after all.
Hey, polydramatic. And I am concerned with our overall sense of the novel and the form of the novel, and I think a clue to the form of the novel is given by the epigraph. Unless a grain of wheat fall to the earth and die, it shall not bring fruit, but if it does die, it brings forth much fruit. And sometimes this takes a great deal of faith to expect this in certain instances in the novel, but I think it serves as a kernel itself. If we think of the process of creation of this novel, that it's something that grew organically in the mind of Dostoevsky in the making of this novel, which could fairly be called a sprawling novel. All right, when we look back at the tightness of Crime and Punishment, we now see something that just unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. And interestingly, in contrast to The Possessed or The Devils, with its frenetic action, this seems to unfold with a certain calm, and there are these great separable parts that in which we exist as if they were all independent of each other. But at the core of it, we have that novel that is structured as existing between the decaying corpses of old men, of two old men, of Fyodor, the corrupt and worldly, sinful, past of Russia. The old Karamazov comes to stand for Russia himself, and ultimately, of course, of the human race, the old Adam. And then Father Zosima, the holy, loving, joyous Christian heritage of Russia. And in that case, a kind of a struggle over the soul, over the future of Russia, and of mankind. And between these two, there is, of course, another old man, right? The abstraction that is Ivan's Grand Inquisitor, and the baleful possibilities for the future, baleful shadow that it casts over the possibilities for the future. With those dimensions in mind, then this novel should, I recommend it, and we come from a tradition that recommends this novel as a point of reference in life. This is one of the great works, and beyond simply being a literary great work, it seems to speak to us and to our world. That reveals something of the dimensions of our own world. I think we will see that further in some of the episodes at the very end, the last part of the novel. So we've seen Dmitri torn between the woman with whom he's in love, Grishenka, and the woman to whom he owes a debt of honor, Katerina Ivanovna. We've seen him, his heart tortured by, his turbulent heart tortured by this duality. We've seen him humiliated, arrested like a common criminal. And we know that he tells about a dream that he's had, right? After he's been arrested and he wakes and he says, "Gentlemen, I've had a good dream." Right? Doesn't sound to us like a good dream, and so it's a somewhat incongruous statement, but it gives a great clue into Dmitri and into all the brothers in this novel. Right?
What section is that?
This is page 4. Oh, boy. if you follow in the Norton, it's page 479. And this is the very end of part 3.
Right.
It's the chapter that's called The Evidence of the Witnesses, the Babe. Right? It's around, he had a strange dream, it says. Utterly out of keeping with the place and the time. He was driving somewhere in the steppes, where he'd been stationed long ago, and a peasant was driving him in a cart with a pair of horses through snow and sleet. It was cold, it was early in November, and the snow was falling in big wet flakes, melting as soon as it touched the earth. And the peasant drove him smartly, snapping his whip. He had a fair long beard. He was not an old man somewhere about 50, and he had on a gray peasant smock. And there, not far off, was a village. You could see the very black huts, and half the huts were burned down. There were only the charred beams sticking up. As they drove in, there were peasant women drawn up along the road, a lot of women, a whole row, all thin and wan, with their faces a sort of brownish color, especially one at the edge, a tall, bony woman who looked 40, but might have been only 20, with a long, thin face, and in her arms was a little baby crying. And her breasts must have been so dried up that there was not a drop of milk in them. And the child cried and cried and held out its little bare arms with its little fists blue from cold. "Why are they crying? Why are they crying?" Mitya asked as they dashed briskly by. "It's the babe," answered the driver. And he goes on. And he asks these questions that are like children's questions. They can't be answered. Why is it weeping? Mitya persisted stupidly. "Why are its little arms bare? Why don't they wrap it up?" "The babe's cold. Its little clothes are frozen and don't warm it." "But why is it? Why?" And so forth. And he goes on. Right? And we see how that chapter ends. Right? "I've had a good dream, Jim," he said in a strange voice. And the dream also, as he wakes up, it says he was suddenly struck by the fact that there was a pillow under his head, which hadn't been there when he had leaned back, exhausted, on the chest. Right? So all these naive questions, it's the first time that Dmitri has ever had these questions, right? These questions are asked in an ontological way, right? They're asked in a way that calls him to notice for these questions. That is to say, it's his discovery in his own way that each is responsible for all. And he's never had that thought before, and now that he's got it, you know, he's not going to let it go.
In the dream, you mean?
Yes. And now, and because he, you know, he comes then, and we gather the idea from the end of that chapter that he's remembers the dream, that he espouses the dream. Right? And the seal of it is that pillow, an act of kindness given to him anonymously while he was sleeping. So that, I think, each, and this reminds us then, each of the brothers has a dream or vision or some kind of altered state experience involving a little child. Right? That, so we're reminded of Zosima's brother who died, Markel, who says each is responsible for all. Not meant, you know, legally, but in a genuine way, that we are all connected. And Alyosha encounters an actual suffering child and has to and gets involved with them directly, right? For the other two brothers, it's more symbolic. For Ivan, it's the most distanced, right? And for Ivan, the very existence of the suffering child is for him evidence that this is not a world worth getting involved in. It's not a world to accept. But for each of them, it's a threshold symbol that indicates where they are to go, what they are to do with themselves. Now, it's also all of these scenes are ambiguous, unlike the Grand Inquisitor, which is Ivan's poem and is really largely unambiguous. With that meeting between Smerdyakov and Ivan that we just went through, we have to notice a few things. It's framed with that strange meeting with the drunken peasant, Ivan, and the peasant is singing a song that's strangely suggestive of Ivan's guilt, isn't it? Right? Did you notice that? Vanka's gone to Petersburg. I won't wait till he comes back, right? And it says at one point, then he remembered those lines, and we know that he knows what they mean now.
Is that the same chapter?
No, where is it? It's the third visit. Where is the third visit?
Is it Snur Yakov?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I would put that around in the
around
Norton 585. The very pages that you were reading from.
Right.
Chapter 7 of that part, chapter 8, third and last interview. Blanca's gone to Petersburg, and he hits the peasant and he knocks him down. The peasant lies there in the snow and he walks on. Right? So I'm not responsible. Right? I didn't kill him. Right. And then after the end of this, when he's terribly distraught, when in a sense he realizes that Smerdyakov is right, he did kill his, he is responsible for his father's murder. He comes back and he sees the peasant and he picks him up. And in a reactment of the a Good Samaritan parable, he takes him and spends time and money, it even says, taking care of, making sure that he will be taken care of. So, and he does it in a somewhat vain, Ivanish way, but but it's real. There is a strange change that has happened. And I don't know if you noticed, even with Smerdyakov in that chapter, page 592. You know, one page, this is in the middle of that chapter. And again, he motioned at the bills. He was just going to get up and call at the door to Marya Kondratyevna to make some lemonade and bring it them. But looking for something to cover up the notes that she might not see them, he first took out his handkerchief. And as it turned out again to be very dirty and used, took up the big yellow book that Ivan had noticed at first lying on the table and put it over the money. The book was The Sayings of the Holy Father Isaac the Syrian. Doesn't sound like Smerdyakov's readings, does it? And that, you know, resonates a little bit with him saying there's just the three of us here. And you think he means you and me and the devil, right? But it means you and me and God. So what is happening? It's Dostoevsky often presents and doesn't necessarily probe into in a totalizing way what's some complex spiritual struggle that's going on in so many of his characters. It's quite possible that Smerdyakov, in other words, has come not to be a non-believer in this late chapter of his life, not any longer to believe. In other words, that if God doesn't exist, all things are permitted. But not to believe that anymore. To believe in God. But that's no guarantee that he believes that God can forgive him. So, as I say, it is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And it seems that, in that case, that would be what Smerdyakov has done. So, yeah.
Would you say that Smerdyakov is in some degree similar to Svidrigailov in that he basically kills himself because he doesn't see any help for his own kids?
I think there's some real parallelism there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now let's move on to another character that I think has some parallelism to Svidrigailov. Please allow me to introduce himself. Not to tease you anymore. I'm talking about Ivan's dream with the devil, and that comes right after this, in chapter 9. Brilliant stuff here. And we note the change of point of view that begins that chapter, if not an exact change of point of view, the reintroduction of the narrator. I am not a doctor, but yet I feel that the moment has come when I must inevitably give the reader some account of the nature of Ivan Fyodorovich's illness. Well, it is a change of point of view because he has to enter the mind of Ivan at a much deeper level than he has done before. And he must make it ambiguous for us whether this was a real visitation by the devil or a hallucination or some combination of the two. And so that we can't really answer that question, although at the same time he also liked to tease us with possible solutions, as Ivan himself is trying to figure this out himself. So now we find that the devil here, an original creation of Dostoevsky, a defiance of so many other literary creations and symbolic creations of reenactments of the devil, or whatever we want to call them, that he's become somebody who gives back Yvonne's own theories, but in the process showing how tawdry they are, how cheap, how banal, that he is, to use our term from earlier in the course, and the embodiment of Poschlust, that he is the kind of devil, however you could say, the kind of devil we see that C.S. Lewis later portrayed in the Screwtape Letters, perhaps inspired by Dostoevsky. Walker Percy's devil in Lost in Love in the Ruins. Right? The kind of devil then who tempts people to an apparent good. There is a, when we think about the writing on the devil, there's Ruth Nanda Anshen, who wrote The Reality of the Devil. And this is one excuse me, work that claims that the devil does not work primarily by urging people to evil, but rather tempts them to a different world, a different creation, right? To building what Dostoevsky might call, in other words, the Crystal Palace, our old friend from Notes from Underground, to offer them an ersatz good. And this line of thinking then, of course, makes the distinction of between sin and evil. Right? And this is a good novel for doing that in, because there's plenty of both. That sin comes out of our fallen nature, but it's always capable of being forgiven. We see that from the very early part in the novel, where we have Fyodor there in the monastery with Father Zosima, and he's Father Zosima likes him, has an inherent affection for Fyodor. Evil is a different matter, and I think we've had a good introduction to it in the Grand Inquisitor. St. Augustine is not wrong about it. It's nothingness. It's the absence of being. But the insight here that Dostoevsky has into it is that it rivals God, right? Is that it offers a replacement creation. And it offers, above all, the spirit of that replacement creation is mediocrity, a safe-appearing virtue. I mean, this devil wants virtue, right? And he wants a golden age in which all will be happy. So, Hannah Arendt's famous phrase, the banality of evil, also seems to apply here. Or Alan Tate, right? Who, to use his phrase, the angelic imagination, our devil here has the angelic imagination. He likes existence in the abstract, but again, the brilliance of Dostoevsky is that this is a character who longs for incarnation. He longs to be a human being, right? He desires the realism of earth, he says, right? And so wants to be a woman weighing 18 stone, as the old translation had it, and so forth. So he's a fallen angel, but in a sense he's been in his post for so long that he's forgotten all of those dramatic early manifestations of the conflict. And he asked, Yvonne asked him at one point, so is there a God? He said, upon my word, I don't know. So his hope is the achievement of Satan has been to set up a counterworld. He works with humanity in building civilization, and that should unsettle all of us. Now, this comes out of a long tradition that, again, if we read Jacques Ellul, that's E-L-L-U-L, on cities, reminds us that the in the Hebrew tradition, God was always against cities, right? That our cities are cursed. The first city in the Bible was built by Cain, the murderer. Yahweh doesn't want his people to build them, but to stay free of them. So all of that whole tradition comes, I think, into play at this point.
And Petersburg sort of comes full circle.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. So that's right. The city built, the most abstract city in the world, the city built out of a dream. So the devil is here recommending good works. Right? And yet, look where we are in all this. We still have to do good works. But now our battle is not, as we thought, perhaps, with people wanting, monsters wanting to do evil things, right? But with a strange mirror universe that once seems to have a genuine envy of God, right? But to have once stayed with it for a long time. To build and really wants nothing more than to do what God has done. Right? To build, you know, something as great. In imitation of God. So that's a tremendous insight Dostoevsky has for our time. Denis de Rougemont wrote a work called The Devil's Share. And this is The Devil's Share. What we see of what Dostoevsky's devil wants. Rougemont says that the essence of the devil is disguise, the art of making forms lie, the great sham. And I think this is something close to Dostoevsky's insight as well. He said, when Christ rose from the dead, he said, I wanted to join in with that, all the joy of creation. I wanted to join in with it too. But then I thought, if I joined them with my Hosanna, what would happen to the world? So there's something of the romantic devil in here. We know that in Faust, in Goethe's Faust, we have... Well, I think he's quoted at one point, but he's quoted at a point that Dostoevsky rightly disagrees with me. He said, I'm the one who always wills evil but does only good. He says, I'm the opposite of that. Right? I'm the opposite of that. I always will good, but somehow evil is what gets done. Right? And that, Jessica, is your Svidrigailov. That's Svidrigailov's problem. He always wants good as far as he sees it, but somehow something monstrous and evil comes out of that. So, but he does say, Faust's devil, said, Ich bin der Geist, I don't know, I shouldn't do this in German, I'm sorry, but I remember it in German. Ich bin der Geist der Stetigkeit. And that's kind of one of his most famous signature lines. I am the spirit who constantly says no, who constantly denies. Now, Dostoevsky reads that in a very different way from Goethe. Goethe believes that's a virtue, right? Because he is coming in part out of the Enlightenment. Right? Or at least, if not a virtue full on, an important spur to ever greater striving. Right? For Dostoevsky, this is the characteristic of the devil that we've just been talking about, that he's the one who denies the good of God and God's creation and wants to replace it with his own. Yeah, Christian.
Are we supposed to identify the devil with the driver of the troika and using the tree's dream? Because their description just to me is a little bit.
Go ahead.
Similar. Well, I mean, they're both described as like a middle-aged-ish man with a beard, and then the devil in Yvonne's dream is identified as this man who pushes away the children. The driver is unconcerned about the problem with the children and the Dimitri stream.
I just saw them as of a different class, but yeah. What do you think?
Well, there's that allusion to the famous troika from Dead Souls as well. And it's seems to me that in both those cases, it's an impetuous rush to almost heedless, you know, people step back and get out of the way, a drive to what, power, passion?
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's mentioned by the prosecutor in the drive. Yeah. Oh, sorry, we're done. We might want to say a few words that'll tie this up a little more.
Next time, yeah, we will. By the way, look, you know, Dr. Collins didn't step very heavily on it. Ultimately, Smerdyakov's sin is not murder, it's despair.
Yeah.
See, that's the point. I mean, and he doesn't try to exonerate himself by passing it on to Vaughn and saying it's your fault. He says you were in this with him,
right?
He takes the blame for it. But it's, he hangs himself out of despair.
I think partly because he decided to miss him, right?
No, I think it's because there's no place to go. He's achieved all this. And
let me just say real quickly for all of you, I know there are a few of you who we missed on the interview conference structure.